Environment Natural Resources Committee hearing for March 17th, Tuesday. And first up, I will open up a public hearing on SJM 11. Beth, if you could give us an overview, please.
SJM 11 urges the United States Congress to provide stable and sufficient funding and to direct the United States Department of Energy to expedite efforts to protect the Columbia River and provide Oregon with a decision-making role in matters including a role in the Hanford Tri-Party Agreement.
Okay. I would like to invite up my esteemed colleague, Senator Devlin, and Representative Jensen.
I think he's the esteemed colleague.
Is it colleagues?
Two of the dying breed.
Actually, two of only three left.
Welcome, gentlemen. Go ahead. Whoever would like to start first.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, and members of the committee.
One. He heard his name outside.
It is. I want to thank you, really, for the opportunity to come and testify on SJM 11.
Oh. Representative, can you please state your name
and
district for the record?
To. Thank you very much. I am State Representative Bob Jensen. I'm from House District 58, which is, for the most part, Umatilla County. And to start out saying I'm happy to come and testify on HDM 11 partially because the site that we are talking about in this is, if you wish, in my front yard, right across the river. As the crow flies, some maybe 30 miles, 25 miles from the edge of where some number of people in my district live and reside. And the Hanford nuclear site is probably the single largest environmental problem that we have in America. And it has been there now, as we all know, since pre-World War II days, as it started out and has continued to process more and more nuclear waste and even having waste now being moved in from elsewhere. This is certainly a national issue. We don't have, as a state, any real direct influence in it. We don't have, other than being downwind from the site, we don't have any other sort of, kind of tire involvement to it. But be that as it may, being downwind is not necessarily, by many of my constituents' feelings, it's not been a blessing for them. So this particular site we've been working on it. I've been on the Hanford, the committee, state group that works with this out of the Department of Energy for a number of times over the past 14 years. And there have been some progress made, but there's still a lot of work to be done. And I think you'll probably hear more about that later. I just thank you for hearing this. I urge you to pass it, send it on, and let's once again get the message to Washington to clean up this mess that we have in our neighborhood here in Oregon, in the Northwest. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone has.
Thank you, Representative. We'll hear from the Senator and then see if there's some questions.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I have prepared testimony, and I'm actually going to go through that, and then I might elaborate a little bit more on some of the reasons why I'm here today. I, as my esteemed colleague to the right, the class of 97, have been on the Hanford Board for a number of years, the cleanup board. Actually just left the board last year. That was a decision of our presiding officer in the Senate. But I enjoyed the service on there, but it clearly became very clear to me that it's extremely important work, and I'll tell you why. this resolution is coming to you from the Oregon Hanford Cleanup Board, and this is not the first time that the legislature has sent such a resolution. There has always been a long-term issue about the federal government's commitment to the cleanup of Hanford and about how that cleanup is occurring. I would say as a state senator, I am approached by individuals and organizations often on environmental issues that affect the state, but rarely does anyone ever approach me about Hanford. And I do think that there is a lack of knowledge in the general public about what exists very close to Representative Jensen's district, but in what in reality exists very close to us all. Hanford is indicated as a decommissioned nuclear production site located in southeast Washington near the city of Richland, the Tri-Cities area. It sits on 586 square miles of land, and approximately 50 miles of it runs along the Columbia River. As indicated, the federal government acquired the site in 1943 for a secret wartime project, and I think most of you would know the name, the Manhattan Project. The site was built to house large industrial facilities that would manufacture plutonium. When the site became operational in 1945, it was the world's largest full-scale production facilities for plutonium. The plutonium produced at Hanford provided the necessary elements for the bomb that was dropped at Nagasaki. And actually, since that time and up until the Cold War, produced largely all the plutonium that was in our nuclear arsenal, all during the period of the Cold War. Only when the Cold War ended were the facilities completely decommissioned. However, the manufacture of plutonium has left a site that is extremely polluted, that has extreme challenges. Current U.S. environmental laws require the cleanup, but to give you an idea of the magnitude of it, and if you ever have a chance, I'd say it would be worthwhile any of your time if you could go to a full one-day tour, which may take you a year to schedule, of the Hanford site. I think you would be surprised by just how significant an issue this is and just how complex it is. There are 1,900 waste sites that have been identified on the site, 177 underground storage tanks that hold 53 million gallons of highly radioactive and chemically hazardous waste. Cleanup, as indicated, began in 1989. The federal government does have a legal obligation to do that cleanup. The board that Representative Jensen and I, in my case, used to sit on was established in 1987. We basically advocate for the cleanup of the site and advocate for that cleanup to actually proceed in a timely manner. To give you some idea in terms of one of the areas on that site, one of the areas is the vitrification plant. This is the plant that will take solid waste from the tanks, convert it into basically capsules, then encase it in actually permanent containers. That plant originally was scheduled to be completed, I think about 2 or 3 years from now, is now scheduled to be completed around 2019. That plant will have to run till at least about the year 2050 to address the needs. Now, there have been some very positive things that have happened at Hanford. The area of Hanford that goes up the Columbia River, the 50 miles there has been extensive cleanup, and many of the issues that are close to the Columbia River have been addressed, at least to this point. The other issue there is that over 200 square miles of groundwater is contaminated, largely by the single-shelled storage tanks that were built in the 1940s and 1950s, that they're now approaching my age.
Yes, son.
Yes, okay. and it presents extreme challenges because as you try to advocate for the cleanup of the Hanford, there are different alternatives. If the vitrification plant was up and running, and the funding was coming to it, that would be your preferred alternative. But the longer that you still have some waste in single-shell tanks that were leaking, some of them may still be leaking, you would like to convert them to double-shelled tanks. To give you an idea of the cost, I think I have the figures by memory pretty close, a four-tank system for this, and somebody behind me can probably give me the number of gallons that could be contained, is about a $600 million expenditure. The vitrification plant is now, I think, anticipated at between probably $12 and $13 billion to complete. We urge your adoption of this resolution. We still anticipate that there will be future resolutions in the future. But the basic problem is that the federal government has to keep its commitment to cleaning up the site. We've worked very well with the state of Washington on this issue. Our Department of Energy has worked very well also. But the basic problem has been that the U.S. Department of Energy, which seems to go through so many different cycles, there never seems to be a consistent pattern of appropriations or work done or contractors who are left on the job long enough to actually do the job. When we get a good contractor, particularly a good general contractor, on some areas, they seem to leave. So we urge you to pass the resolution. We'd probably be back in a few years and ask you to pass another one, but we need to keep putting pressure on the federal government to keep their commitment to the western states.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions? Okay, I just want to thank both of you for your service and on the committee, the task force, whatever the official word is, and I know that you're no longer on it, Senator, but wanted to thank both of you for your service and your leadership on this issue, because it is a very important issue. I know that we can send a strong message to Congress, which I do believe that we need to do, and I appreciate, again, your leadership, because it'll be many lifetimes, I think, that we are working on this issue at this rate, unfortunately, and I do believe that we need to send a very strong message to Congress to expedite that. So appreciate both of you working hard and bringing this forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We appreciate the opportunity to have been here to testify before you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
We have a couple of folks that are signed up to testify on this and would like to hear from them. Ken Niles, Department of Energy, and Doug Riggs with the Hanford Information Network. Ken, would you like to go first and state your name, please, for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm Ken Niles. I'm the Assistant Director at the Oregon Department of Energy. I basically head up the State of Oregon's oversight of the Hanford cleanup, and I appreciate your words of thanks to Senator Devlin and Representative Jensen. They've been very active members of the Oregon Hanford Cleanup Board for a number of years, and their leadership on the board is very much treasured. I have just some very brief comments. It's when you look at the Hanford cleanup, it's a little bit overwhelming to realize that in just a couple of months we'll hit the 20-year anniversary of the start of cleanup. What's even more overwhelming is that by most people's accounts, we're only about a third of the way done. 2050, 2060, 2070, those are all dates that people look at as potentially the end of cleanup in Hanford, and at this point it's just impossible to say when that would happen. We had a very slow start to Hanford cleanup, but after that slow start, we've seen a lot of progress in recent years. We've seen the risk to the Columbia River and to Oregonians greatly reduced, but that risk still remains. And as Senator Devlin and Representative Jensen implied, we're in it for the long haul. We have to be. Because the decisions that are being made today, the decisions that will be made over the next few years, will have impacts on Oregon and the Columbia River for the next many decades and, in fact, many centuries to come. The Oregon legislature has affirmed its interest in Hanford cleanup, its support of Oregon's involvement in Hanford cleanup through the passage of resolutions and memorials virtually every legislative session since the mid-1980s. And we appreciate your consideration once again. We think it is important for a couple of reasons. From our standpoint at the state level, working with the folks up in Hanford, it does reaffirm a very important level of interest on Oregon's behalf of our involvement. Even though we do not have regulatory authority at Hanford, we are very much impacted by what may happen. And it clearly indicates our intent to remain involved. In addition, our congressional delegation, can use this memorial and has in their continuing efforts to make sure that we have sufficient funding for the Hanford cleanup. So with that, again, thank you for your consideration of this memorial. I urge its passage, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. I do have a question. Thank you very much for your testimony. What is the current allocation for Oregon for the cleanup for oversight? I'm assuming that there is an allocation that comes from the feds, or is there a state match that we need to provide?
We do receive a grant from the U.S. Department of Energy. It's $750,000 a year.
And is that a continuing appropriation, or how does it have to, we have to go back to Congress and get that reauthorized? How does that work?
Madam Chair, it is a year-to-year funding issue. For the most part, under the current leadership at Hanford, they do seem to recognize Oregon's interests and the benefits of having Oregon involved, and we have not in recent years had any issues with securing that funding.
Thank you. Any other questions for the department? Thanks. Doug?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs, and I'm here on behalf of the Hanford Information Network. I'm here not today with a lobbyist hat on because I'm not a registered lobbyist on Hanford issues. We do not lobby on legislation, and I think this is a great bill, but I can't say vote yes or no. But I can talk to you about something that I think is very important that we've worked with the Department of Energy on, both state and federal level. We got into this in 1997, 1998, when we looked around. A group of us who had been working on Hanford issues for the better part of a decade wanted to ensure that more people in the Northwest were aware of what was going on at Hanford. We took a survey, had a sample size of about 475 people in Portland, Olympia, and Seattle, and the results were relatively shocking. 92% of the people that we asked had no idea where Hanford was. They had no idea what Hanford was. They had no idea that 53 million gallons of waste was about to come down the Columbia River in the event of a terrorist attack or an earthquake, and they had no idea what the consequences to the Columbia River would be of something like that happening. And so our group decided to approach it from an outside of the legislative process approach and get out to the public and talk as much as we could about Hanford cleanup and why it was important. So we started out by holding public forums. We put together a proposal for the Washington Department of Ecology to take our presentation, not Hanford good or bad, but Hanford needs to be cleaned up message into high schools. And we got a small grant in 2001. We began putting together a presentation. Our presentation is multimedia. As you well know, kids in this day and age have grown up in the MTV or the YouTube generation, and they want short snippets of information that keeps them engaged. So we have a presentation that has a lot of questions, a couple handouts, a Lego display, 3D Lego display of Hanford, which the high school kids love. We have a video that was produced by the Oregon Department of Energy that we show to the kids, and we have a waste to glass presentation using sometimes it's Ultra Slim Fast, sometimes it's Atkins Low Carb Shakes, sometimes it's, you know, Yoo-Hoo, but a variety of different things to try to keep the kids really interested and engaged. I point out something that's been mentioned earlier today. This is two-thirds of the volume of the nation's nuclear waste in our backyard. And yet, again, 92% have very little idea that this is going on. The problem with our presentation is, as a volunteer coordinator, there are about five or six of us who've been making this presentation. We've been out to close to 700 classrooms in the last 6 years. We've presented to well over 10,000 kids. But we can only get so far. And so we expanded our grant to be able to expand this educational outreach proposal beyond just the ability of in-person presentations. So we're creating what you see here on the screen. It is almost hot off the presses. It was unveiled about 3 weeks ago. We made our first presentation two Fridays ago to a school up in Vancouver, Skyview High School. And the goal is to provide students with a medium that they understand and appreciate and provide materials to teachers that they'll be able to present. This is a lesson plan themselves without us having to be in the classroom. And so I'll just flip you through here really quick. I won't go into any great detail. But we have incorporated materials produced by the Department of Ecology in Washington, by the Department of Energy in Oregon. And let's see if we can get this actually to flip up here. But actually the first thing you'll see popping up here on the blank screen is the Department of Energy's video on the Hanford cleanup. You'll notice elsewhere that we try to keep it very engaging and topical. People need to understand what radiation is. Why are we concerned about radiation? They need to understand the history of the Cold War and World War II. So what you find with Hanford is that when you get out into classrooms, there are a number of opportunities to educate kids about issues that they have some understanding of, but you're able to connect the dots, and we found that's very successful. So I won't go into great detail, but we have pages on the cleanup process. One of the things we're using at Hanford is molasses to see if they can treat groundwater that's contaminated using molasses. We have a Hanford trivia quizler, which asked kids if they know that there was a racetrack at a nuclear waste site, that some people thought they were making toilet paper at a nuclear waste site. Do cockroaches die when they're exposed to radiation? So types of interesting questions that kids are going to find worthwhile. Why the Columbia River is threatened. And we have a whole separate page, which will be password protected at some point, so it won't be corrupted, but for teachers only, and how to use the site in their classroom. So overall, obviously, we're very supportive of Hanford cleanup. It's $2 billion annually. The great thing that we need to make sure occurs more often is that the next generation is aware of it. As Ken mentioned, this is a cleanup that will go on through 2050. So catching kids at the stage where they're deciding, do I go to college? Do I go into the trades? What do I major in college? Do I want to be an environmental engineer? What are my career options? Those are the types of things where we can have a real impact on the outcome of the cleanup. The technology does not currently exist to fully clean up Hanford. You know, we've cleaned up the plutonium in the middle part of the site. We've cleaned up the spent nuclear fuel. But there's technology that will be developed by people who are now in grade school and kindergarten and high school that will be instrumental to making sure that this site is cleaned up to a stage at some point 100 years from now, which we'll be able to use the whole site for human contact. And that's really the exciting part about this, because you go into the high schools and you see just what a great job our educators are doing. And given the option, kids want to be involved. They want to participate. So I would urge you to take a look at our site. I think you'll learn a few things if you take a look at it. Any suggestions, we're open to. But we really appreciate the partnership we've had with the Department of Energy in Oregon. Ken's done a great job. Mike Rainey's done a great job. They provide excellent representation on the Hanford Advisory Board, the Hanford Cleanup Board, and we've appreciated working with them. So thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions? Okay. Appreciate you being here today and sharing this website with us. We'll actually send out the link to our members, and thank you for the department for being here. Okay, so with that, I will, is there anybody else that would like to testify on SGM 11? It has not signed up. Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on SGM 11, and I will open up a work session. Grab Mark, if he wants to come in.
We'll just Madam Chair, I'd move SGM 11 to the floor with a to-be-adopted recommendation.
Okay. Senator Atkinson moves SJ 11 to the floor with a be-adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Well, ma'am, I'll just kind of talk until Senator Haas gets here.
I think Senator Haas just walked in. So, okay, seeing no discussion, is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, the motion passes and SJM 11 is adopted. And I am going to assign Senator Devlin as the carrier, since it is his bill, and I asked him, and he said he would be delighted to do that. So,
delightful man.
We will send that message to Senator Devlin, since this is a very important message that we need to send to Congress.
Does he have a time limit as to presentation on the floor?
We will.
Can we vote on that?
Yeah, I think we should. We'll make sure and convey that to him, that brevity is appreciated. With that, I will close the work session on SGM 11, and I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 486. Beth, if you can provide us with an overview, please.
Senate Bill 486 limits the length of time up to five years that additional taxes and interest can be applied retroactively for land withdrawn from open space special assessment if the land was classified as non-commercial open space land for at least five consecutive years prior to being withdrawn. And this would apply to properties withdrawn from the assessment for tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2009.
Thank you, Beth. And Senator Brzozinski, do you want to say a few words? I know you have a constituent here who's going to speak on this bill, but I saw your name on the bill, so if you'd like to say
Your
anything.
Honor, yeah, if you want to go ahead and call Maureen up, and I'll...
Sure. So Maureen Gray Hudson from Lane County.
And I'd say if you'd also would call up Gil Riddell.
Gil Riddell is back there. Come on up, Gil.
And as they're coming up, Madam Chair, this is a bill that Ms. Hudson approached me about regarding a specific issue that involves her property. As a constituent, I told her I'd be honored to put forward some legislation for her. She's going to explain to the committee as to what the situation is as it pertains to her. Gil is going to also give a perspective based on how the bill was written and the, let's say, broader, let's say, consequences that the bill may have on a statewide basis as compared to addressing Ms. Hudson's issues. And so between the two, what I expect is we'll take the testimony, we'll decide on what will come after that, after this hearing.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. And I'm assuming, Maureen, why don't you go ahead and go first?
Well, thank you. Thank you, committee. I'm very happy to be here and tell you our sad little story about our forest ranch.
And can you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Maureen Gray Hudson, and we live southwest of Eugene in a forested area and have just about 100 acres, which is modest by timberland, but timber isn't our main concern. Our main concern actually is preserving this very beautiful little micro eco I'm getting nervous now but a beautiful place, an environment that has actually a bit of everything in it. I mean, it's like a textbook of Oregon natural history, and we try to run the place in that manner and have a very protective and selective sustainable method of forestry. And it works well in small property. We wish it could be applied to larger properties. Maybe it could. In the meantime, a couple of years ago, we needed a new bridge to get across a large Spencer Creek and access some of the property to be able to do a thinning job. And we went to our credit union, Northwest Community Credit Union, and applied for a loan to get a bridge. And after a while, they got back to us with the information that they could not get behind tax-deferred properties. And I was rather confused by that. I went to the Lane County Assessor's Office and talked to them. And according to one of their exemption experts, 75% of rural Lane County is in some form of tax deferment. And I thought, well, is this an issue of rural redlining, or is there something else involved? And it turns out there was something else involved, and it might have been that they really didn't have much experience with this, which was that besides our F2 zoning, we have open space assessment. My father-in-law, Harlow Hudson, who taught architecture at the U of O many years ago, was one of the early proponents of open space, and he went before the county Board of Commissioners and got some kind of an approval. We have a little letter, but we never knew if it actually took effect legally. You know, what does this really mean in terms of state law or regulations? Well, we found out that the credit union sees something like this as tax liabilities. They're afraid that they could be somehow liable for taxes from the early 70s to now, the difference in the property tax that was not paid because we are in open space assessment. And we tried to explain to them, look, if almost 70 years of preserving and maintaining a place doesn't speak for itself, I don't know what would. But obviously, we're not going to be changing use. And if we did decide to, get in with a developer and put up condos, Spencer Creek Valley condos, what have you. You know, the question of the difference in taxes owed would be no problem. But that is not what they were concerned about. So I got a hold of my senator, and he started to look at various remedies. And Senate Bill 486 does try to address what we've been facing, and I suspect other rural landowners too, as they face the questions of how to maintain property, which of course is very important to maintaining the county tax base and the state tax base too, as we, you know, would be doing timber extraction. So we're open to whatever solution the committee might think would be useful, and we are, you know, concerned about maintaining open space. We think that's a very important concept. Our neighbors also are very much in favor of it. We have an unofficial green belt right now, and we'd like to see it official someday, but in the meantime, we need to be able to get in a bridge, and we're looking for some help and solutions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hudson. Appreciate you sharing your story, and I would like to hear from the county.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. The purpose of open space designation, it's a special assessment, and it's designed to preserve open space and green space. It's also the advantage of it is that you're subsidized by other taxpayers. You get a special assessment. It's intended to be difficult to get out of because of the intention of preserving open space. So the back taxes that are owed when one taxpayer applies for the designation, if the taxpayer chooses not to continue, then the back taxes go to the date of filing the initial application. The way this is drafted is that it undercuts the intention of the concept of open space special assessment, limits back taxes to 5 years. It seems that you have, basing general policy on an individual situation is always risky business. There are unintended consequences. This is one of those items where you're looking at a significant change to a general public policy. So conferring with the proponent and Senator Brzezinski, we're talking about some other ways to approach this would be more narrowly focused rather than a sweeping change of general policy.
Okay. Appreciate that. Are there any questions or comments for either of these? So it sounds like, Senator, you're willing to work with the counties and with Ms. Hudson and see if we can narrow it, because I do share the concern that you have. We want to make sure we're encouraging open space, which I do support, and I thank you for doing that for many years, and certainly want to try to see if we can resolve this. So any other comments, suggestions? Okay, we'll look forward to hearing progress on this.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anybody else who would like to testify in this bill, Senate Bill 486? Okay, with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 486, and we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 599. And Beth, if you can provide us with the overview, please.
Senate Bill 599 modifies the definition of surface mining, excludes excavation or reprocessing of aggregate material from the highway right-of-way or grading operations if it is necessary for the construction, reconstruction, or maintenance of a public transportation facility. It would apply to all operating permits issued before or after the Act takes effect.
Okay. Thank you, Beth. With that, I'd like to call Gary Lynch up from Dogami, and actually Rich Engstrom from OCAPA, if you'd like to come up and...
Dogami.
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 Actually, I'm going to have Amy Joyce come up as well from the Department of Transportation.
That's right, Dogami.
We'll have everybody up here signed up. So, Gary, happy St. Patty's Day to you as well. You can tell some of us were not appropriately dressed. Some were over appropriately dressed, but...
Is that to you or me?
I was looking that way, but... And some of us were misinformed. So, anyway, if you can provide some more background on this, why this legislation is necessary, appreciate it.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, and excuse me if you break into an Irish brogue on occasion, but it is a great day for us.
quite well.
Long, long history there. This bill is to correct a very important bill from last session, at least a small part of it, in Senate Bill 149. That was a comprehensive bill that we worked with a number of parties on and successfully went through the legislature and the governor signed. And as we were writing the Rules Advisory Committee, we had, which is required to have a broad-based group on it, including ODOT and OCAPA, environmental group, a raft of others. We recognize that it is arguable that there is an unintended consequence in the portion of the bill that is in bold. And in the past, if ODOT or a county were working within the right-of-way, they did not need a permit from Dogami. And we even testified that was the case then, and it should have been in the bill. Language came out of the bill that, again, made it arguable that if ODOT was working within the right-of-way, they would need a Dogami permit. And that was never the intent of the bill. This is the correction to me not spending enough time looking at the final draft to see that language had been twisted a little inadvertently. And this bill corrects the situation and puts it back to the way everybody agreed it should be.
Why don't we hear from the other folks first, and we'll take questions. Rich.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And for the folks who are listening, tell people what OCAPA is, because we shouldn't use acronyms, actually.
I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association, also known as OCAPA. It's too long to say, so we've got as short as we possibly could.
I see you, OCAPA.
We have, this language was put together by myself and a person from ODOT to correct this situation that Mr. Lynch was talking about. The only thing that I want to point out is this is not in any intent to allow any private sector folks to get around the land use code for aggregate siting. It applies to ODOT and counties and probably cities at the same. And it really is just when they're working in a right-of-way from a practical side of things, if they're removing aggregate materials in doing the roadbed and constructing the roadbed, that those aggregates can be used right on site and not have to get an MLR permit. It's just efficient government to have it done that way. I guess really that's pretty much all I have to say on it. It's just a fixed bill from last session.
Okay. And Ms. Joyce?
Amy Joyce, Department of Transportation. Ditto to what these fellows have said. And I would note, too, that requiring the permit of ODOT wouldn't give any extra benefit to the environment or provide Dogami with any particular extra information. It was an inadvertent miss and can save the department about $100,000 a year if we don't have to get this permit that probably wouldn't do anybody any good.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. And I also see that you have written testimony in support of that. Okay. Any questions? I see Senator Boquist is out reading the statute, so I thought I might have some questions. Any questions there?
I'm just, Madam Chair, relieved that ODOT would be out of giving the MLR permits to members of OCAPA that would be graced by Dogami.
It is quite alphabet soup, isn't it? We are full with acronyms.
I feel much more comfortable now.
Do you want to say for folks who don't know what MLR stands for?
It
the mine land, excuse me, Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's actually MLRR now as of 98. It is the Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation Program. And if you ever want to have a good time, spell Doug Amy backwards and you'll understand our confidence.
I'm a dog. I'm a guy.
Close. Some would interpret that.
Right. Well, I appreciate you bringing this forward, especially if we're going to be looking at a savings of $200,000 per biennium. Now, this would be from the Highway Trust Funds, or is this general fund?
Senator Dingfelder, Highway Trust Fund.
Okay. Just wanted to clarify that.
The union is...
Okay. Appreciate you bringing this to our attention. If there's no other questions at this time, we'll wait until we get the paperwork on this, which we don't have right now. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 599. There's a lot of noise coming from this side of the dais. And next, we will open up a work session on Senate Bill 391. Beth, you can remind us about this bill. Probably not that we need that much reminding. And I think we want to... Yeah. Actually, I think Senator Boquist can...
Senate Bill 391 adds a member of the Order of Crocodilia to the definition of exotic animal, exempts wildlife sanctuaries, law enforcement agencies, and other organizations from the permit requirement. Just for the record, the committee did receive a no revenue or also a minimal fiscal impact. No statement actually issued for this bill. Committee want to amend that?
Yes, and we do have a dash one amendment. Is that right, the dash one? So if you could explain that.
In front of you, the committee, you also have, and in the back of the room for the public, is the dash one amendment, which is deleting line 11, which would be removing any wolf from the definition of exotic animal. And I think there are people here to go into greater detail.
Okay. Senator Boquist and we'll see if Senator Haas has any comments, since you're the co-sponsors of the bill.
Madam Chair, it was
Chief co-sponsors,
by some citizens and other senators, you know, the status of wolves in Oregon, and as you know, I was in the opposing party of wolves for the last two sessions. And several senators, we sat down and looked at it, tried to analyze, okay, why is the wolf an exotic bill in the exotic pet, exotic regulations of the state of Oregon? And in a nutshell, our bill predates the Federal Endangered Species Act, in a nutshell. And in reviewing it, the wolf is regulated under the Federal Endangered Species Act, and we in the state of Oregon have had the wolf in the, at least part of the wolf, in the under the Department of Agriculture, which under federal law, you must have a plan and a management and a federal authority to regulate it. Luckily, we only have two wolves under the Department of Agriculture. And at this point, the amendment, and we'll ask, if you will, Madam Chair, when I'm done speaking, ask the two departments to come up. What the amendment does is pulls the wolf out, makes it very clear that it does need to be regulated under the Endangered Species Act, which the closest thing we have is the Wolf Conservation Management Plan that's before the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Department at this time. Both departments will come forward, as we do have two permittees. Department of Fish and Wildlife is committed to try and find a solution for that. But the issue really for the amendment is that it's federally regulated, and that authority at closest goes to the Department of Fish and Wildlife and not the Department of Agriculture.
Okay. So, Senator Prezanti, did you want to add anything to that?
No.
Okay. So we'll ask the department, I think we have the Department of Fish and Wildlife here and the Department of Agriculture. Why don't we ask both of you to come up? You can do that on the floor if you want.
I just did it in the hall. We
heard. Yes.
That or the bat signal, but that's another exotic pet.
Okay. Well, we got three for the price of two, so.
Three.
Yes. Okay, who would like to go first if you have any comments on the amendment?
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture, and with me I have Dr. Don Hansen, the state veterinarian that oversees the exotic animal permitting program within the Department of Agriculture. And if the committee would like, Dr. Hansen could give you the briefest overview of the purpose of the exotic animal permitting program and how the wolf fits into that.
Yes, please.
Okay.
Go ahead and please
for the record, I'm Don Hansen, state veterinarian, Oregon Department of Agriculture. Madam Chair, and respective members of the committee, Our purpose, the purpose of 609, which is the statute, is to encode four different groups of animals, exotic animals, into regulation. That would be the exotic cats, non-indigenous to Oregon, non-human primates, that runs from a small capuchin up to a chimpanzee, the wolf, standalone line, as you know, with the Dash 1 Amendment, and then non-wolf member of the family of dogs, such as fennec foxes, and then bears, any bear except the black bear. So that's the piece. And the purpose of the law is to protect the animals, to put them in regulation so that they are, their safety and welfare is assured, and, importantly, that the public is protected from any damage or risk that those animals might pose to the public. In a nutshell, that's the law.
Do you have any comments on the amendment?
For the record, Lisa Hansen. The agency is not taking a position on the bill or the amendment.
Okay. Kurt, why don't you go ahead?
Chair Dingfeld, members of the committee.
Can you move the mic towards you, please?
For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Some mornings I wake up and wonder who I am. Too.
Yes, I'm calling you by your secret twin, Kurt, because I deal so much with Kurt.
The agency has some prepared testimony that's being passed out to you, and basically with the Dash 1 amendment, what it would do is by default, the wolf would become a protected non-game wildlife within our own statutes, within the agency, and how they would be regulated by us would be up to the commission, and they would have to go into rulemaking to determine how or if they wanted to do any regulations at that point in time. As protected non-game wildlife, it'd be illegal to own them, but the commission could, by rule, make exceptions to that.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any questions for these folks? Senator Buckwist.
Madam Chair, just so that we get it on the record, can the Department of Agriculture tell us how many permittees there are, and then can the Department of Fish and Wildlife confirm that they're going to try and work to resolve those two permittees?
We have three.
Three. Oh,
three.
We found
which
another.
Is, okay. We didn't find another. We have three. Okay. There's one in Jackson County, one in Josephine County, and one in Benton County. Altogether, there are 22 wolves among those three permittees.
22 wolves statewide, you're
that
saying?
That we permit.
Okay.
That's correct.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist, to answer your question, we feel it would be appropriate. They already have these animals. We feel it would be appropriate that there be some kind of a grandfathering in of those existing facilities, and it would not be appropriate to just say you can no longer have these animals and have to get rid of them. So.
Well, that's what this bill does, is my understanding. Yes, that's what this bill does. They're grandfathered in. Yes.
Due to the relating clause, we can't directly pass it to the department. What we would do is be eliminating them from the exotic pet side and transferring it over to the Department of Fish and Wildlife, who can confer with its federal allies under our wolf management plan and work with a solution. We're also searching for a bill, because the relating clause here doesn't give us the wording or the relating issue, so that we can actually fix it and give that authority to Fish and Wildlife. And Beth is using her good services to find me a related bill, and since one of them is in my district, thank you, Senator Brzezinski.
You're welcome.
That I can resolve. We'll find a solution to this.
You can work with Senator Atkinson, since he has two in his district. Senator Hess.
First, I want to make sure from Fish and Wildlife that this, if this amendment is adopted, that the intent here is to maintain wolves as non-game wildlife. And there is an intent in the rules that these will be prohibited from ownership. Is that something you could say?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hass, yes, they would still be protected non-game wildlife, and if there was legislative intent that the department was not to engage in issuing additional permits other than the existing three, then that certainly makes it very clear and easy for our commission if they were requested to go into rulemaking.
Okay. And one follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
What if we didn't, what problems do you see if we did not adopt this amendment with respect to wolves?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Haas, things would continue as they are currently under Department of Ag and under the original bill 391. It's my understanding that those existing wolves and facilities would eventually phase out.
Okay. Any other questions?
Just a follow-up.
Senator Berquist.
Just for the Department of Agriculture, do you have, because the issue that came up when we studied this is that under the Federal Endangered Species Act, you have to have authority to issue and regulate wolves. And does the Department of Agriculture have any authority from the federal government to regulate wolves?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Boquist.
Okay, people often confuse us.
The odd couple, that's what
they call us. The mustache throws me off.
There is no specific authority that we in the Department of Agriculture are aware of that would allow us to maintain this permitting system. This is a new issue that just recently came up as this discussion has been bubbling along about what to do.
Bubbling is correct.
It's like Brody
and Brody and day.
A bad combination.
Right. I think bumbling was appropriate, actually.
Bubbling
is what I was trying
okay.
to say.
That there could be some issues. We have followed what the statutory requirement has been for us in issuing these permits over time. And, you know, to a very limited extent, clearly with only three permittees in the state.
For the record, I mean, yeah. Department of Agriculture has been doing what we told them to do. It's just that, I guess, after 6 years of discussing, no one ever asked it, why are we doing this? And their statutory authority predates federal laws.
Okay, Senator Brzozinski.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. I guess for the legislative record for ODFW, I'm asking that the ODFW go into rulemaking to actually carry out the intent of what the discussion is today. Clearly, what may have started for other reasons as to whether or not the wolf should be considered an exotic animal and understand why it was labeled that before it could actually go through this process. But the reality, from my perspective, it is a form of wildlife. And I think it is appropriate for the agency that is directed to deal with wildlife, and in this particular case, non-game wildlife, to actually exercise the control. And they are, in fact, as Senator Boquist said, working with the federal counterparts. And so to me, it's important that we make certain the correct agency is doing it. It seems to me that this will actually clarify and make sure that we are in compliance with whatever federal rule is now in place that may not have been in place at the time when the first, statutes were passed, putting the wolf within the jurisdiction of the Department of Ag. And so it seems appropriate that ODFW not only have this, but go forward with the rulemaking to ensure that those three would be able to be grandfathered in, as we would call it, and to make certain at the same time that others aren't able to proceed. And I would also, I guess I want to put on the record that I would assume that there's going to be a process for, if necessary, that any other exhibitors, such as a zoo that may have wolves, would in fact be able to still legitimately maintain them. What if they have to go through a process through ODFW, so be it. Maybe they don't need to because they're going through the U.S. Yeah. But just want to make certain, if that's necessary, that we cover that base as well.
Do you have any comments?
Chair Dingfelder, yeah. Senator Przanski, thank you for that clarification.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll look forward
to
working with you as we move forward with this. Yeah. I wanted to see if anybody from the Humane Society wanted to come up and comment on this amendment. And then we also have legislative counsel here if we have any questions.
Thank you, Senator Dingfelder and committee members. My name is Kelly Peterson, and I work for the Humane Society of the United States. And thanks for asking me to come up briefly. And we are okay with the dash one amendment with the understanding of some of the questions that Senator Brzezinski clarified with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, that in fact those permittees will be grandfathered in, so that we're not talking about taking their animals and euthanizing them, that they will be grandfathered in and that they will remain as non-game protected wildlife. And that's our hope. And I guess that's it. But I just wanted to put that on the record that those were our concerns. And I think they've been addressed based on what ODFNW said today.
All right. Thank you, Kelly. Any questions? Thank you for coming up. Okay. With that, we are in work session, so I will entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments.
Okay, so yes. Senator Atkinson moves to adopt the dash one amendments dated March 10th, 2009. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 391 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 391 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Hess.
Thank you. I just want to say one sort of housekeeping thing. I think everybody in the committee got a letter from OMSI. There was some discussion from somebody who testified against this bill that they had worked for OMSI. And just to clear things up, OMSI sent us a letter saying that person didn't represent OMSI, and in fact, OMSI supports this bill. On the overall bill, I think wild animals should live in the wild. And the second alternative to that is that wild animals, if they're not living in their own habitat, should be cared for responsibly. And I think that hasn't changed throughout the discussion of this.
Great. Thank you, Senator Hass. Any other comments? Okay. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Boquist?
Aye.
Senator Sosky?
Aye.
Senator Hass?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Yes.
Chair
Aye. With that, the motion passes, and I will assign Senator Hass and Senator Boquist to co-carry this to the floor.
Challenge. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 391. And we will open up a work session on Senate Bill 596. Beth, if you can refresh our memories on that one as well, please.
Senate Bill 596 expands the list of brominated flame retardant chemicals designated as hazardous substances to include decombrominated diethanol ether. Provides the introduction or delivery for introduction into commerce of any product containing more than 0.1% by mass of decabDE. Do you want me to go into the amendment?
Yes, if you can go into, colleagues, we have an amendment for this bill, and Beth's going to review the amendment. And
so just briefly before you, you have Senate Bill 596-1. The proposed amendment provides an exemption for the manufacture, sale, repair, distribution, maintenance, refurbishment, or modification of any new raw material or component part used in a motor vehicle or airplane. It also exempts replacement parts for products that enter into commerce before January 1st, 2011, and extends the effective date of the Act to January 1st, 2011.
And my understanding is that this is consistent with the Washington legislation. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
They actually, Washington allows mattresses already outlawed, but the rest of it will go in on that same day. So I don't think it's unreasonable that we go in at the same time.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? It's committee. So I would like to ask Dave Barris to come up. Wanted to comment on the amendment. Mr. Barris, thanks for coming back.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Dave Barrows, the Citizens for Fire Safety Institute. Speaking to the amendments, we cannot support the date change that was proposed in the amendments, because to do so would be an admission, we think, on our part that DECA causes a problem, which we do not believe. Nor does the EPA believe, nor does the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission believe, both of which have studied DECA extensively and have refused to ban it. And I would also say, Madam Chair, with all due respect to the Senator and to the committee administrator, this bill does not even come close to paralleling the state of Washington. They have a very complex system in which a number of state agencies have to reach agreement that there is an alternative, safe product available in the marketplace before the 2011 date even kicks in. So it is a very different bill. This is a very strict, draconian bill. The other state which has adopted it, which is Maine, has exempted almost everything out of the bill. So they say we ban DECA except for these products, which is almost everything DECA is used in. We also oppose the notion of exemptions for autos and airplanes. And we do so on the basis, Madam Chair, that if this product is so dangerous for firefighters, which we suggest it is not, why should people in cars, including babies and flyers who are already subject to bad air, be subjected to this evil product? Why would we exempt anything if it's so horrible? We would respectfully suggest that the committee join the National Fire Marshals Association, many state firefighters organizations, as well as the American Burn Association, which is all MDs or experts on burns, in setting this bill, just not killing it, just setting it aside until the National Institute of Standards and Technology has completed the study of DECA, which many have asked for, including the National Firefighters Association. We believe this study will be done by the end of the year. This bill could even be brought forward in the supplemental session in 2010. We just think this is premature. We will have the most severe ban law in the nation, which may be all right for people. But there are many, many people who think it is very premature and that the studies have not brought forward the information necessary to make that kind of a decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Barras. And for the record again, can you state who you're representing?
The Citizens for the Fire Safety Institute.
Okay. And for the record, who are they?
There are a number of people. They are the American Burn Association, people in the firefighting business. It does include, as I indicated to Senator Hass at the hearing, it does include the three companies who make DECA. I'm not trying to hide the ball on that regard, but it is also a whole lot of other people.
Thank you. Are there any questions, comments on that? Okay. Thank you for coming forward today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Okay. So we are in a work session.
Move the dash ones.
Okay. Senator Atkinson has made a motion to adopt the dash one amendments dated March 11, 2009. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the dash one amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I'd move the bill as amended for the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 596 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Great. Is there any discussion? Senator Boquist.
Briefly, Madam Chair, as you and I have discussed before, we have some concerns on the adequate substitutes, so on and so forth, but until I get an answer back from that I've requested elsewhere, I'll support the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Boquist. Any other comments? Okay. So seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Boquist?
Aye.
Senator Pazomski?
Aye.
Senator Haas?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Yes.
Chair Dean
Calder? Aye. Seeing that there are no objections, the motion passes. And Senator Haas, would you carry it to the floor, please?
Honored.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 596. And colleagues, I want to note that we are done early today and appreciate your patience last week. And we will be back on Thursday. With that, I will close the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources.